Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Have you ever wanted to speak another language? Whether you want to speak Spanish, French, or German, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons can get you speaking confidently in your new language within weeks. Babbel's spaced repetition method gradually builds your language skills so you intuitively remember what you've learned. No wonder Babbel is the number one selling language learning app in the world. Try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com or download the app. That's Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com, or download the Babbel app to try for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 5th of July, these are our main stories. The BBC has discovered that thousands of children from Uyghur families in western China have been separated from their families. Dozens are feared dead as a rubber boat loaded with migrants sinks off the coast of Tunisia. Tehran has reacted with fury after British Royal Marines seized control of an Iranian supertanker carrying oil to Syria. Also in this podcast... The end of an era for American satire. The BBC has obtained evidence that Muslim children in China's Xinjiang province being systematically separated from their families. Government documents show that large numbers of state boarding schools have been built to house children as young as two. The BBC has already reported on a vast network of re-education camps for adults in the region, where more than 1 million people are detained. With his latest special report is our China correspondent, John Sudworth.
In a meeting hall in Istanbul, 60 Uyghurs, Muslims from Xinjiang, are clutching photos of their children. Over the past few years, they've watched helplessly as the husbands or wives or grandparents they'd left in charge of them back home have been taken to the camps.
Where are they now?
I don't know if they're alive or dead.
Who is looking after the children?
They were detained in a child education camp.
Adrian Zenz is an independent researcher who first revealed the existence of Xinjiang's adult internment camps. Now, in work commissioned by the BBC, his evidence shows that China has been building something else too. Giant schools, many of them with dormitories, and in which the Uyghur language is not allowed to be spoken.
The Xinjiang government is attempting to literally raise a new generation that has been cut off from religious beliefs, from cultural knowledge, even from their own language. I believe the evidence really points what we must call cultural genocide.
The Chinese government denies it is running detention camps, insisting instead that they are schools to help combat violent religious extremism. It also denies that large numbers of children are being left without parents as a result. But such cases are not hard to find. Back in Turkey, we hear of whole families disappearing and from parent after parent grieving for their missing children.
John Sudworth. Another boat carrying migrants from Libya to Europe has capsized, killing at least 80 people off the coast of Tunisia. The few survivors said they'd sailed from Libya. One of them, Suleiman Koulibaly, described what happened.
It was from 5 till noon. The boat started to sink and the water was getting into the boat. Some fell into the water. People were traumatized. Others fell into the water. They stayed there.
The boat sank in waters off the town of Zarzis. Charlie Yaxley, who's from the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says people traffickers are to blame.
Depending on the movements of the Libyan Coast Guard, smugglers are adapting So they will wait until they see an opportunity and send out people, regardless of the safety, to do so. And there needs to be an effort to hold to account the smugglers who put people's lives at risk by putting them in rubber dinghies in an attempt to cross the Mediterranean. You know, it's these networks that thrive on people's misery and so on. While this violence continues in Libya, the demand will be there.
So how many people survived? A question I put to our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Very, very few. Four were rescued by fishermen. There were 86 on the boat. So there are 82 people missing, presumed dead. Of the four who were rescued, one is now well and has been put in a centre for refugees who've been rescued. Two are still in critical conditions. One is in a coma and one has since died. So this is another one of these tragic incidents that have actually become slightly rarer recently because of the moves that have been made by Italy, backed by the EU, to strengthen the Libyan Coast Guard in the last year or so, which has didn't close down this migrant route, but it certainly made it a less attractive option.
Yes, because this comes just hours after an airstrike on a Libyan detention centre killed more than 40 migrants.
Yes, it did. And that really brought back the focus on the situation of migrants, not just when they're at sea in the Mediterranean and the dangers they face there, but what they face when they are stopped and taken back to Libya, which is what the UN and aid agencies said shouldn't happen because Libya obviously is not a safe place. And essentially where they are, these detention centres where we've already had appalling stories of their treatment, they're being used essentially a form of slavery, some of them sexual assault, being held against their will, all those sorts of stories that we've heard, torture, lack of food, lack of water. But where they are now has become the front line of a new battle in the past 3 months with General Khalifa Haftar, the strongman from the east, attacking Tripoli. And his air force, such as it is, as far as we know, were responsible for two airstrikes which struck one of these detention centres. We now know that 53 people died in the attack. We're also hearing that the people there were being used, actually, by the local militia, who are allied with the internationally recognised government that General Haftar is trying to remove, were being used to help them with their munitions, essentially to clean their ammunition, to clean their weapons. This is an appalling situation. Just one last thing on that. We're seeing, again, an upsurge in the numbers of migrants and refugees risking the Mediterranean crossing from West Libya because of the unrest and the fighting that's gone on in the past 3 months. The Libyan Coast Guard is not doing the job as it was recently. So I think we may well see more incidents like this as summer comes, which is the season when the migrants try to make the crossing.
Sebastian Usher. Piracy is how the Iranian Foreign Ministry has described the seizure of an oil tanker in the Straits of Gibraltar by British Royal Marines. A spokesman in Tehran said the move was illegal and the tanker should be immediately released. The vessel is suspected of carrying 2 million barrels of Iranian crude oil to Syria in breach of European Union sanctions on Damascus. The British Foreign Secretary is Jeremy Hunt.
Well, I can confirm that our ambassador in Tehran has been summoned by the Iranian authorities to protest about what happened. But our position is very straightforward. Sanctions are there for a reason. They must be adhered to. And the real way to solve these issues is for Iran to cease its destabilizing activities across the Middle East, to talk about how we can come to a long-term settlement that secures Iran's place as an important regional power, but also peace and stability throughout the Middle East.
The Spanish Foreign Minister says the seizure on Thursday morning took place at America's request, as Washington is enforcing an embargo on Iranian oil sales. The US National Security Advisor John Bolton described it as excellent news. The intelligence appears to have come from the United States. The tanker is believed to have been tracked leaving Iran. Suspicions would have been heightened as rather than going through the Suez Canal, it had sailed around the southern tip of Africa. My colleague Chloe Tilley has been speaking to BBC Persian's special correspondent Kasra Naji.
It's a very long tanker, oil tanker, and apparently it had set sail from Iran. Any oil to Syria is sanctioned, so this is breaking, or they suspected that the ship was breaking the sanctions against Syria, and that's why British Marines were involved, the Royal Gibraltar Police were involved, the local Gibraltar customs people were involved to do this. Iranians are angry. They protested this against this seizure, and they have summoned the British ambassador in Tehran to the foreign ministry, and the Iranians are calling it an illegal seizure.
Remind us of the political backdrop to all of this, because this goes beyond an oil tanker being stopped, doesn't it?
It is. And my first reaction when I heard it was that this is an indication of the worsening, really, relations between Britain and Iran. This is one of those cases that we didn't expect. Why is it happening now? This has been going on. Syria has been under sanctions since 2011. It's the first shipment that is being impounded in this way. It's the only explanation is that it's an indication of how things have got worse between Britain and Iran, particularly in the light of the continuing imprisonment of the young mother, Nazanin Zaghari, who's been in jail in Iran for more than 3 years, and the British Foreign Secretary is saying that she's being held as a leverage, political leverage, for political ends, hostage, if you like, and they want her released. And that has impacted relations between Iran and Britain. There are several issues. There's a huge amount of money that Britain owes Iran is one of the another issues between the two. The attack on the BBC Persian staff is another issue between the two countries. So there are many issues, but I think the overriding reason may have been this continuing imprisonment of Nazanin in Iran.
I also understand that it was the US who tipped off the British about this ship being there. And of course, you've also got the backdrop of the relationship between the United States and Iran at the moment.
That's right. Don't forget that Americans are keeping a very, very close eye on what Iran does. And in terms of oil exports, they want to bring the Iranian oil exports to zero. So they're watching where any illegal oil might be going. And the suspicion is that Americans were aware of this ship and they were tracking it. And they, once it got to the Mediterranean, they informed the British and the Gibraltar authorities and they took action on this.
Kasra Naji. The former governor of Rio de Janeiro says he negotiated bribes to secure the Olympic Games for the Brazilian city in 2016. Sergio Cabral told investigators that he arranged for the payment of $2 million to win the support of 9 of the International Olympic Committee's 95 members. I asked our America's editor, Candace Peart, for more on Sergio Cabral.
Well, he's the ex-governor of the state of Rio de Janeiro and a very well-known politician. He's currently serving a series of very long sentences in a Rio jail for passive corruption and money laundering and embezzlement. And in the middle of this today, he's just decided to, for the first time, to give real details about bribes that he paid, $2 million to international athletic officials in exchange for up to 6 votes in the meeting that awarded Rio the 2016 Olympics and Paralympic Games. And he said also that Brazilian Olympic Committee senior officials handled these negotiations and that he also said that the ex-president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and the former mayor all knew about this.
Because the 2016 Rio Games were very controversial in Brazil, weren't they?
They failed on so many levels. Do you remember pacification? It was intended to de-escalate tension between police and gangs with patrols in the shanty towns of Rio. It now looks like that strategy was made things much worse after the Olympics, and the number of deaths during police raids doubled in the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And improvements made during the Olympics, including the construction of all these stadiums and games facilities, They were supposed to be converted into public facilities. That didn't happen. They've been left abandoned, decaying, vast white elephants. And as soon as the games finished, there were accusations that it had helped bankrupt Rio. Rio ran out of money and for various reasons. But so the games in many ways have been seen as a very negative factor for Rio.
Candace Peart. After 67 years, the American comic magazine Mad is to cease regular production. It won't disappear completely, but will largely be limited to repackaging old material. A combination of silliness and satire, Mad made the image of the gap-toothed schoolboy Alfred E. Newman famous even outside America. More from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd. Agnes,
oh Agnes, oh. EC Comics launched Mad in 1952 alongside its horror and sci-fi titles. The point of Mad was to be funny. Soon it had a sideline in Satirical Records. The heyday was in the mid-70s when each edition sold some 2 million copies. Over the decades, Alfred E. Newman, the usual Mad cover boy, barely changed. Short red hair, gappy grin, sticky out ears, and a suggestion of amiable stupidity. It was definitely not a compliment when, in May, President Trump, referring to Democratic politician Pete Buttigieg, said Alfred E. Newman cannot become US president. Significantly, Buttigieg, who's 37, said he'd had to look up the reference. Mad's readership has been aging and diminishing. From 2010, a TV series based on the magazine gave a new lease of life for a time.
The Avengers have put a stop to your dastardly deeds, Red Skull.
Why Red Skull always choose evil?
I don't know. I have a skull. It's red. My options are limited.
The current publishers say new material will now be limited to end-of-year specials. The magazine, they say, will feature classic, best-of and nostalgic content from the last 67 years.
Vincent Dowd. Still to come in this podcast.
Mon coq. Il me gêne pas, il chante.
My rooster doesn't bother me. He crows and I think it's great. Long live nature.
Don't wake the neighbours, the cockerel that's been taken to court in France. Now, picture this. There are reports that a man was captured, drugged and smuggled across a front line disguised as a paralysed pensioner. This man is Vladimir Seymour, potentially a key witness in the shooting down 5 years ago of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, in which 300 people were killed. Ukrainian special forces are said to have seized him in the rebel-held east of the country. Our reporter Olga Ivshina is covering the story.
Many people believe that he was in charge of anti-aircraft missile of a town called Snezhnoye. That's the closest town to the place near which MH17 boy was shot down. So, of course, some people believe that he could have known what have happened. Well, we have managed to find out that he appeared in Kiev on the 27th of June, and on the 28th of June, he was put under arrest. We don't know anything more for sure, but we have spoken, a colleague of mine, have spoken to his daughter, and she confirmed that he disappeared from his flat, and also that there were, you know, signs of some blood on the walls. So definitely he was resisting.
And then this report that he was smuggled out disguised as a paralyzed pensioner. I mean, this is extraordinary. This is like a spy novel.
The thing is that the town of Snezhnoye is quite far away from the conflict line. So it's like 80 kilometers from the official checkpoint and 45 kilometers from the front line. And of course, you know, all those checkpoints are tightly controlled. So in order to get someone out, you need to either to disguise them or to move them out illegally. There is a second version that they just risked it and made it directly through the front line, not through the checkpoint. It seems that top secret service of Ukraine, Special Operations Service of Ukraine, was in charge of these operations. We haven't confirmed that from the Ukrainian side because they just refused to comment, but it seems to be the case.
Has there been any response from Russia?
Well, no response in Russia, of course, because they keep claiming that, you know, they have no relation to that tragedy. Daughter of this gentleman told us that they have discussed this question with her father a lot, and he always said he had no relation to the tragedy. She claims he had become in charge of the anti-aircraft system of Snezhnoye way later. But actually, you know, documents and photos from that time suggest maybe he wasn't in charge, but he was definitely dealing with this issue in summer of 2015, not only afterwards.
So this story not over yet?
Oh, definitely it's not over. He'll appear in court, and of course he'll be an important person possibly speaking on this topic. And pro-Kremlin bloggers, users already saying that definitely, you know, he has no relation to the case. He will be drugged and he'll be tortured to say something against Russia, and we shouldn't believe a word he says because it will all be done under torture. And the Ukrainians say, listen, that's a key witness. He'll open us the truth.
That was our reporter, Olga Ivshina. A court in Britain has rejected an extradition request from India for a couple who are accused of arranging the murder of their adopted son for an insurance payout of nearly $190,000. Arti Deer and her partner Kaval Rajada, who live in London, deny they had anything to do with the boy's murder. Nikesh Raghani reports.
In February 2017, a group of masked men attacked 11-year-old Gopal Sajani in the street in Gujarat, stabbing him several times. He died from his injuries 3 days later. His brother-in-law, Hasukbhai Kardani, was also stabbed to death after trying to stop the attack. At the time, 54-year-old Arti Deer and her 30-year-old partner, Kaval Rajda, had already moved to London. Gopal, who they'd adopted 2 years earlier following the death of his parents, never came to the UK with them. He was living with Mr. Kardani. The couple are accused of arranging Gopal's murder so they could claim on a life insurance policy they took out in 2015, just a month after adopting him. They deny the allegations. The Chief Magistrate, Emma Arbuthnot, agreed that there was sufficient evidence to warrant a trial, but she said she wouldn't agree to extradition because the couple would be tried in Gujarat, where the punishment for murder is life in prison without parole. She ruled that went against Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights.
Nikesh Raghani. And now to the controversial sale of a 3,000-year-old bust of the Egyptian boy king, Tutankhamun.
I'm selling here at £4 million. All done. Last chance at £4 million. Sold at £4 million. Paddle 845. Congratulations.
The Amun head sold on Thursday evening at Christie's Auction House in London for £4 million, $5 million, despite an outcry from Egypt's Antiquities Ministry, which claims the artefact was stolen during the 1970s. Our reporter Beth Timmins has been on the trail of Tutankhamun.
So, Alex, it's life-size. It's got a reddish tint. It's about 28 centimetres large, and it's made out of this quartz material. And it depicts Tutankhamun in a typical headdress that we know him so well for wearing. And it's famous and instantly recognisable as Tutankhamun because he has these serene almond eyes. The ear and nose are damaged on the piece, and it was made by the Amarna sculptors in the Karnak temple complex, which is near the Valley of the Kings. So it's a very rare piece.
And what's the controversy here?
So Egypt and the UK are both signed up to a United Nations convention in 1970, which is against the unlawful export of cultural property from museums and archaeological sites. So we have a case of claim and counterclaim. And back in 1983, Egypt introduced a law banning the removal of artefacts. So the Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities, Mustafa Waziri, has said that he believes this piece was taken illegally.
We will not stop our pursuit, especially that these are our Egyptian antiquities. Whether they were extracted from Egypt in the 1960s or the 1970s, they have to present evidence that would prove that they own this archaeological Egyptian piece and that it was taken out of Egypt lawfully. I believe it was taken out of Egypt illegally. As yet, they haven't presented any documents that prove otherwise.
Mustafa Waziri, the Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities. But there's a long history of artefacts being plundered from Egypt. And this looting intensified after the 2011 uprising, didn't it?
Yes. So in the past 5 years, Egypt's managed to recover 1,500 illegally trafficked objects that have made their way into Europe and other countries around the world. So it's really quite a huge amount that were taken after these uprisings. And the Metropolitan Museum of Art and also Bonham's Auction House have returned quite notable pieces to Egypt already. So the sales of antiquities are increasingly sparking these disputes over provenance. But Christie's reply was that it was impossible to track historical objects back over millennia. And they say that they're adamant that the sale is in order. So despite the Egypt Foreign Ministry asking the UN and the British Foreign Office to halt the sale, the head of antiquities at Christie's, Letitia Delaloy, had this to say.
We have been in touch with the Egyptian authorities, both in Cairo and the Egyptian embassy, and we informed them about the sale even before the catalogue was published. And we've given them all the information that we have over the piece, because through this research, we are confident that the legal status of the piece and the title of ownership is clear.
So they understand that they've done their due diligence and are happy that the sale has taken place. And we just still don't know who the lucky owner is, Alex.
Beth Timmins speaking to me earlier. He's the club's record goal scorer, a hero to the fans, and now Frank Lampard has returned to Chelsea Football Club as manager. Lampard has signed a 3-year contract with the Premier League team in England to replace Maurizio Sarri, who's left to take charge of the Italian champions Juventus. These Chelsea supporters have been in touch with the World Service to give us their views.
My name is Ben from Boston, Massachusetts. My first reaction waking up to the news this morning was a sense of finally, this has been teased out for so long. I had just been waiting for it to be confirmed. Overall, you know, I think I'm like many Chelsea fans. I'm absolutely thrilled for this. I'm ecstatic. And whatever the results end up being, I have not been this excited for a season in a long time. Welcome home, Frank. Roll on 2019-20 and beyond. Up to Chelsea.
Yeah, hello. My name is Sulaiman from Nigeria. I know there's been a lot of talk about his inexperience, especially the fact that he spent just 1 year managing Derby County. For me, I don't see that as a big deal at all, because with due respect to the last manager that we had, Mr. Sarri, he had well over 30 years in his managerial career and he hasn't won anything.
This is Chelsea Jones from Sierra Leone, West Africa. We saw what Zidane did in Madrid, so we expect much from Frank Lampard. And I'm very happy to say this. Lampard will be one of our greatest coach again. We love Lampard and we are very, very happy to have Lampard as our manager this time.
Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss reports on what some fans are calling the return of the prodigal.
He's known by Chelsea fans simply as Super Frank. As a player, Frank Lampard was the cornerstone of the club's glory years, winning 11 major trophies. His return to Stamford Bridge, though, is something of a gamble. Lampard is Roman Abramovich's first ever British managerial appointment and has only one season of experience in the dugout of the Championship side Derby County. Speaking at a press conference, Lampard said he was immensely proud to be in charge at Chelsea.
I've had 1 year at Derby where I think I learned a lot in 1 year. And also I think I know a lot about this club and feel this club and know how it works. So I have to prove that. Simple as that. People will question it. I'm ready for that. And I want to show that I'm ready to manage this club, whether I've had 1 year experience or 10 year experience.
Lampard has arrived at a particularly challenging time. Chelsea are currently serving a transfer ban, meaning he's unable to buy any new players. Instead, he'll have to nurture the club's own young talents, such as England international Callum Hudson-Odoi. And with the owner not famed for his patience, he knows his past glories may now count for little.
Andy Swiss. And now, your wake-up call. How would you like to be woken by that sound? Every morning, a couple hoping for a peaceful retirement on the French island of Oloron are so enraged by a cockerel that lives nearby that the pensioners have gone to court. Monsieur and Madame Biron claim the animal, called Maurice, is an abnormal noise disturbance which must stop. It wasn't in court in the western town of Roquefort, but its owner, Corinne Fesseau, who's been living in Oloron for 35 years, was.
Mon coq, il me gêne pas, il chante.
My rooster doesn't bother me. He crows and I think it's great. Long live nature. I think that now the case must be heard to say that the countryside has a right to its noises. Roosters are allowed to crow. They don't crow from 4:30 in the morning indefinitely.
The cockerel is one of France's emblems. It's used by the national football team. So outside court on Thursday were Maurice's fans, a chicken called Pompidou and a giant rooster named Jean René. The case has certainly ruffled feathers in France. Maurice's supporters across the country have signed a petition defending its crowing And it's being viewed as a debate on French rural identity, the decline in traditional farming versus the changing face of the countryside. But it's a classic dispute between neighbours over noise. The couple's lawyer, Vincent Ubadeau, says his clients just want a tranquil life.
My clients don't blame the rooster for singing. My clients want it to be quiet in the morning, between 6:30 and 8:30. They like to be able to sleep. The hen house is less than 3 metres from their bedroom. They're disturbed by the rooster's crow, as they might be by the barking of a dog, by the sound of a lawnmower, by the sound of an engine.
Our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield, is following the case.
It's about a cockerel which has been crowing in the town of Saint-Pierre-d'Oléron, which is on the island of Oléron, just off the coast near La Rochelle. It belongs to a lady in her 70s called Corinne Fessot. And what's happened is that the neighbours, two of her neighbours, are complaining. They're saying that this cockerel is disturbing them, waking them up. They've retired next door to her and they want a life of peace and tranquility, and they can't have it because of this cockerel. So it's a neighbourly dispute which has come to the courts and which has attracted the attention not just of France but all around the world, because for many people it sort of epitomises what they like to see as this conflict between, you know, ancient rurality and modern unfeeling urbanites who are settling in the countryside and understand the first thing about how the countryside really operates. The woman who owns this cock is not some farmer. She's a singer and has decided to have a cock on her street where there are lots of houses around it. And the plaintiffs are farmers who've retired. So, I mean, that's why it's had this resonance, because it does, you know, sort of tick all the boxes when it comes to sort of cliches about France and rurality and so on. And there are people, yes, who say that she should have the right to have a cockerel. I mean, it is traditionally in France, in the countryside, people did have cockerels. At the court case this morning, there are people have turned up with other cockerels to express support.
Hugh Schofield. And a verdict in the case is due in September. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.